when we could still get the discount for them, I went and got the I got that free, that $40 discount for the DTV converter, and I had gone and gotten one for myself. So last year I finally decided to put it into use. I'll let it drop for a moment. It took me about 2 weeks to get acclimated to the loss of having all those channels at my fingertips. And I find I spend less time in front of the television now, and that leaves me more time to pursue other interests. And as far as an internet connection, the library's down the street from me, so free Wi-Fi. And there is, of course, my cell phone. I just thought I'd submit that to your consideration, N2RDB.
From your town in West Hempstead, I think you said, Tim, roughly how many over-the-air digital television channels are available to you? Over to you, Tim.
Well, considering that my antenna is in a poor location, there is a place I can mount it up higher and more in the clear, which I will get around to one day this summer. Well, in the poorer location, I have approximately 15 channels at my disposal, not including a number of sub-channels with each of the major channels. And, well, that includes a number of channels which are in Spanish, and there's a Korean channel in there, and most of the major ones in English, but some of the foreign language channels as well. So I actually have a pretty good selection. Most of them have a very clear picture. Some of them are not so good. But I got that little boxy-looking indoor-outdoor antenna from Radio Shack. And I just have it hanging up outside my window. And there is a place on the side of the building where I could mount it. N2RDB.
What you're about to find out is that when you do put the antenna higher up with a rotator, in the old days, you only needed a rotator to pick up the DX stations. With digital television, you need the rotator to null out some of the multipath so that some of the channels will lock in. Let's see how Bob is doing down there, K4NBC. I wonder if you're watching over-the-air digital television, how many channels you get, Bob. K4NBC, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, thanks. K2RIW, K4NBC. To answer a previous question or comment that you made before, thanks for the good audio, by the way. Yes, I'm coming in on Echolink. And I got rid of that 99-cent microphone, and I got the $2.99 microphone here. So that's why the audio sounds so much improved. Okay, that being put aside, I found out that WTVJ's Channel 58 was shut down in April. Forgot where I had it here, but it went down in April of this year, and NBC surrendered the license because the power upgrade for the digital filled in the void there. Looking for it, damn it, I lost it. It was W58 something or other. And the two low-power analog stations, one has a CP for 150 kW, and the other one just went to 150 kW, and they are now digital. So unless DX comes in from Canada, there's no longer any analog television available in Florida that I know of or within range of my tower. And let me drop it for a second. Over-the-air digital depends on where the I aim the antenna. I have a TV antenna way up on the tower there at about 180 feet. I can pull in just about everything, even some low powers out of Orlando. I aim the antenna at Tampa. I get Tampa stations, and when I swing it south, west, I can get Fort Myers, Naples stations, and when I swing it due south, I get Miami and West Palm stations. So the total it all up, by the way, a lot of them are duplicated programming, but when I total it all up, I don't know, I'd say I get about close to 100 off-air stations.
Those are nice numbers. And you're also in a part of the area, part of the United States, where sporadic E and other kinds of extended ground wave-like propagation occasionally occurs. Digital TV or analog TV-wise, either one, what kind of DX have you seen on short periods of time there, Bob? K4NBC, K2RIW?
Oh, I got a story for you. Well, lately, for the last maybe month or so, or 6 weeks, 10 has been open. 6 has also sporadically been opening. And I still have a TV antenna with low-band elements on it. In fact, it's only up 10 feet off the ground on a TV mast that's shoved down in a hole. And, you know, I'll run out there and spin it around when... like if I'm dialing around on 6 meters and I hear video buzz on 55 to 25, I'll turn on the old analog TV and I'll spin that antenna around and see if I can pinpoint it. But most often it's almost always, as a matter of fact, it's on channels 2 to 6, and you tune in, you listen to the programming, and when they say I've been out and about, you know, then I know I'm hearing Canadians. So, but most of the analog TV that I'm getting is DX from Canada when 6 meters is open. Let me drop this for a second. The day that analog TV ended, and it seems so fitting, Dick, but the last day of analog television, it was like God opened up the band. And I'm sitting with a TV antenna that's up about 25 feet. Where the DX antenna used to be. And I'm watching WNBC, you know, switching over to the nightlight NAB tape. And I'm getting WCBS TV Channel 2, and I'm getting Fox 5. And then as the afternoon progressed, the band moved west, and I started getting 2 out of Detroit and 5 out of Chicago. And Channel 2, I think from Nova Scotia, I made videotapes and took stills off the TV. So it seemed fitting on the last day of analog TV, we were able to get a lot of it, and it was pretty amazing. It seemed so fitting. The MUF would be up there into the FM broadcast band that day. I was also getting DX FM broadcast stations. K2RIW from K4NBC.
Fantastic, Bob. Some of those are approaching 1,500-mile ranges for television reception. Was any of that just a very unusual propagation, or is it because the local channels on those frequencies went off the air, and therefore the first time you're seeing the DX? Or maybe it's a combination of the two. Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
No, that's what the low-altitude antenna was for. To the south of me, you've Googled my QTH. You don't see it in the satellite, but to the south of me, to my immediate south on the other side of the property there where that big artificial lake is at the power plant, there's a 30-foot dike. And if your antenna is lower than 20 feet, because some signal does kind of leak over the dike, but if you have a TV antenna below 20 feet, then you're only going to get 3 local UHF stations from the east that's in the county here. So you got to get above 30 feet. I took that antenna down that day, and I put it on a 10-foot mast because I noticed earlier that the band was opening, and I thought there might be a shot. When it was opened up to the northeast, and I thought there might be a shot that I might be able to get this. So when it happened, and the band stayed open all day, so I had the antenna up actually maybe about 8 feet off the ground, because I had the 10-foot mast shoved into the sand about 2 feet, and I had it out in a clear area, and I would turn up the TV real loud so I could hear it out in the front yard there while I was spinning the antenna so I could point the signal. So I had the antenna deliberately low, so none of the low band stuff to the south of me, 5 and West Palm Beach, the closest being. Whoops, we're back. Anyway, 2 and 4 and 6 are out of Miami, and 5 is out of West Palm Beach, and 5 was the closest. So I wanted to make sure I didn't have any local interference on the DX, and that they turned out just the way that I hoped it would be, and I got nice clean pictures some of the time, but most of the time it was watchable, syncable. You could hear other channel 2s and 4s grinding in there, and depending on who won the capture, another interesting phenomena. I can be listening to Channel 2 out of New York and be watching Channel 2 out of video out of Pittsburgh. That was another interesting thing that I recorded. So, but anyway, it was like a 4th of July send-off for analog television.
Mother Nature was telling us something on that day that we're really going to miss it. Bob mailed me a nice website that you guys can look up. It's on YouTube. This was a television transmitting tower, I believe, in the Netherlands, in Holland. And the way some of the television stations are built in Holland is about a 10 or 15 story round building. Oh, I'm going to guess the building is like 30 feet in diameter and 10 or 15 stories high. And then on top of the building was a single diameter radio mast, a constant diameter three-legged mast that went up, I'm guessing, another 200 feet. And I think lightning struck it. This happened on July 15th, and some smoke was coming out of this broadcast antenna, and the news media had moved in to show you pictures of it with the smoke coming out of it, and while they were there, it collapsed. So I think if you Google the word YouTube and television station that fell down on July 15th, it's exciting material to look at. Did I have it correctly guessed that it was a Dutch station? And all of the YouTube was in foreign language. K4NBC, K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
What's more amazing is while this one was on fire and burning down, so was the Netherlands' other main television facility on fire and burning down. I know what you're thinking, but they're saying that's not the case. They're saying that it was overheated lines, and they were overheating, and they were changing out the lines on both of these towers. So that thing was like 1,000 feet high. And the transmitters and studios, I guess they stick studios in those things too, I don't know. But the building that it was sitting on was like 330 feet tall. And then it had 700 feet of tower on top of it. So, like up at Empire, I've seen some pretty nasty arcing damage to stuff like elbows and and on flanges and transitions and stuff like that. So, but it wasn't a lightning issue. So the lines overheated. It could be because maybe they lost pressure, summertime and the effect of the sun and whatever. Who knows? But I've seen it happen before. The jacket on the line catches fire.
Wow, exciting stuff. Now, that's 1,000 feet of tower. It would have to be guyed in multiple locations. I didn't see the guy wires, but I guess that's just a resolution problem of the video. 1,000 feet. And it, essentially, not the bottom 300 feet of building, but the top 700 feet of tower all came crashing down. Exciting stuff. So your best guess is just RF overload and maybe loss of pressurization. And with all that smoke coming out of the tower for a long enough period of time to move in the news media, had the television station used good common sense, I think they should have either killed the transmitter or gone to a much lower power to make the smoke stop coming out. The fact that the smoke continuously came out suggests that either there's more burnable material there or they were continuing to transmit. You got a guess on that one, Bob? K4NBC, K2RIW?
Okay, sure,
Bob first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Bob.
No, that stuff was already off on its own due to temperature and self-propagating down the line. The temperature, you know, making the metal hot, taking the temper out of it, the tension from the guy wire snapped, vibration, you know, the tower snake wiggles, and then boom, it self-collapses. No, I don't think they were transmitting because... you know, the reflected power circuitry in there would sound an alarm and the transmitter would automatically shut down. But by the time that could have happened, the jacket on the line is already taken off and it's, you know, taken on, you know, a life of its own. And no way to extinguish it either. Back to you, Dick.
I'm amazed that the outer jacket is that flammable. KE2EJ, I wonder if you've seen that video, Eric. Go ahead.
No, I haven't, Dick, but I will soon. But as far as, like, being a television transmitter or a broadcast facility, 6-inch coax with jackets? Nah, I don't think so. I mean, I've burned up 6-inch line, and it smokes for hours. And every few feet, there's a Teflon insulator. And once you get a flammable gas in there, which is what happens when you get a meltdown, and all it takes is, you know, one good meltdown, and you start to get a cascade of fires within the pipe itself. So even though the Teflon burns, and the pressure increases inside, and even though the thing's supposed to be filled with nitrogen, some people use air, so... You're putting oxygen in there. All my lines have been filled with nitrogen, so you only cook like one section or two sections. But I've seen pictures of people who use air on a high-powered line. You wind up with a lot of volume of burnt material, so I can imagine that the smoke was pouring out of it for quite a while, and the radios themselves are generally made out of fiberglass, so if you've got flames shooting out of the side and it starts the fiberglass up, then, you know, all bets are off. I suspect the building is something like what the Russians and the Iron Curtain folks used to build. And if you go to, like, Berlin, you go to the east side, you see one of those kind of buildings. With the tower is on top of the building, and it'll be anywhere from, like, 500 to 700 feet. And usually they're supported from inside, not outside. K2IW, K2J.
When you say supported from the inside, I presume you're talking about the building. But the tower extending something like 700 feet above the building, that would have to be a guide tower, would it not, Eric? Go ahead.
Think of it this way. If you have a 700-foot or 1,000-foot self-supporting tower, and they have them, they've got these huge bases, now build a building around it.
A 5,000-foot self-supporter I ever saw was WTCG Atlanta, channel 17. You now know it as WTBS.
Yeah, but most of the self-supporting towers I've seen are built like a Eiffel Tower. They're very broad at the base. This tower, if I had to make a judgment, I would say it was 3 to 4 foot triangular and constant in dimension all the way up to 750 feet. That's an extremely skinny slenderness ratio. I'm having great trouble believing that you could support 750 feet of tower only from the base, and the base is, I'm going to pick a number, 4 or 5 feet wide, and constant dimension all the way up. I think the forces would be much too great, but that's just my impression. I will admit that a structure like that would look a lot more homely with guy wires, and if they tried to eliminate the guy wires, I could see it. But to get a man to climb that structure, my goodness, 750 feet above a support, wow. I mean, when I was assembling my Roan 55 tower, there was a time when I was, for a short period of time, 40 feet above a support. And boy, was that uncomfortable. And Roan 55 is, by my standard, very sturdy tower. When you were assembling your structure, Bob, what's the maximum number of feet you ever stood above a support? And I'll bet you it was pretty snaky until you put on the next set of guy wires. K4NBC, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K4NBC returning. Well, 55 is 30 tower. That's what I've got. And I'm 30 feet above the last guy station. It does move a little bit up there when I climb on top of it. I sit on the very top of the tower, and I'll just sit up there and, like, you know, have a cigarette and talk on the phone. It moves only a little bit. It can't go anywhere. And that Dutch tower, by the way, was guide. It had five guide stations on it, meaning five per leg. So the heat melted the metal where one of the guy wires was, and when one of them lets loose, the whole tower vibrates back and forth, and the downward weight is not centered, so it will collapse. Just the way it did. So, anyway, I hope that answered your question. Nobody in the building was hurt, by the way. I took an interesting note, though, you know, that they seem to like to do that over there in Europe, build these, like, cylindrical buildings that are high. And I presume that they stick studios in there, too, because they're going to have a great view. And then... Sorry about that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we heard you say they build studios in there, and they get a great view. That was the last words we heard before you got timed out. When you played back that YouTube video, were you seeing enough resolution that you could see the five sets of guy wires? Is that how you found out about those guy wires? Bob, go ahead.
No, I didn't. But I think I read somewhere that... that each leg had five guys on it, which would be about right. But, you know, I can just look at that thing and tell you it's got to be guide. It's not possible for 700 feet of tower, you know, to be supported by, you know, the 300 underneath it, as thin as it is. And, you know, and without going to a wide base, because that downward weight has to be distributed. The taller it is, the wider the base has to be, because the weight has to be distributed over a wider area. So so it doesn't blow over. So the they all have to be isolated, so to speak.
Yeah, I wonder if you had any strong feelings on that article I mailed you, and maybe you didn't get a chance to read it all yet. It was kind of lengthy, about using a two... methods of support when hauling up tower sections on a high tower. in order to not have the drop tower section syndrome, where you drop a tower section and collapse the whole structure and kill a whole lot of people. I don't know of anybody who has ever used that technique that I've used, and maybe I'm a little bit too much belt and suspenders, but when that much life and limb and the property is at risk, to not do that to me seems foolish. I wonder if you got an opinion on that thing that I mailed you. K4NBC, K2RIW.
Yeah, I did look at it, and I don't know. I thought it really wasn't that necessary and creates a lot of extra work. And really shouldn't be needed if you don't exceed the weight limits of, you know, the cable that you're using to hold stuff up with, or the pulleys or whatever. Plus, you know, you have your equipment, you know, constantly inspected for cracks and defects. My friend George W4QJP used to have pulleys and shackles, stuff like that, eddy current tested to make sure that the metallic structure was constant throughout the you know, the whole piece there. Sometimes he would have stuff dye penetration, ultraviolet dye tested, you know, for hairline cracks and stuff like that. So, and he's proud to tell you that these S&S Tower never killed anybody. So, I don't know. Too many people have been doing it that way so long. Yes, it's, it is double safe, but maybe not really necessary. Although there have been accidents. Versus I'm sorry, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that accident scenario of dropping a tower section that cuts through the lower guy wires and collapses the whole structure, something like 10 tower rigger people die per year in that scenario in the United States. So something's not being done right. And yeah, maybe it's a little bit too enthusiastic in safety, but some kind of force limiting has to take place on the derrick that's holding on the wire, or testing. Quite often the failure occurs when they're holding up the top section and they want to save time and they put the antenna on it, so they're holding up twice as much normal weight, and they're holding it to the very top of the structure. And sometimes a couple of guys are riding that thing on the way up. So you got human being weight, extra antenna weight, plus the top tower section all being hauled up at once. And I've seen a few of those movies of what it's like when that falls. Okay, let's see if Paul Wade, Paul WS2N is available. I think the space shuttle comes back this week. WS2N, are you there, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Paul is not there. And did you read as many of the emails as you wanted to, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mel.
I missed the last question. I had to answer the phone.
Did you read as many of the emails as you wanted to? You could read another one now if you want to.
I just about covered it, Dick. Just go on with the TechNet. I'm pretty tired.
Okay, catch some shut-eye, and we'll see you next week, and be well. Now we get into the more serious stuff. I see by this email that I've gotten from Wesley, he's got quite a number of subjects. We may not get to them all, but one of them is with reference to ferrite donuts being used in a particular way where you alternate low permittivity and high permeability donuts in order to get a particular benefit. And so let me turn it over to you, Wesley, for further explanation for what you believe is the advantage of doing this. I didn't get a chance to study it. I had an automobile failure, I had a washing machine failure, and I had oral surgery all this week. RIW, N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
N2XJN. Yeah, N2XJN. Well, the reason for that was that there is a certain agreement of alternative layers of low permittivity and high permeability materials suitable for high performance choking. And basically, it works this way that you have, and you have a link underneath, if you can open up that link, right under the picture that you've got. The Philips Laboratory made a consideration for loading balloon using ferrite and ferrite dielectric sandwich. So basically what they were doing is they took the ferrite ring and they took dielectric, could be even the spacer, could be just here, and another one. And they were measuring optimal ratio for the thickness of ferrite to the thickness of the dielectric material in the balloon. And in order to achieve optimal impedance properties of the frequency, let me jump. So, for the typical sense of the parameter, the optical optimal factor of the half ferrite and half dielectric had been suggested. But they were making a number of different tests giving a wider spacing in it. So they were able to achieve higher impedance and better performance of the ferrite. Now, that's the first thing that I'm going to touch. Have you ever get across that? Because then there is another article from another lab that was using the same concept. So, what you have is every second slice, you have a low permittivity and high permeability. So low permittivity stands for dielectric, high permeability stands for the ferrite. I was interested with it when I was looking at the graph showing the incremental impedance on the sandwich based on the spacers, and was showing better performance of it. Back to you for now, and then I'm going to go wider with that.
I have the impression that this is an ultra-wideband choking device, which doesn't have the normal resonances and things like that as a disadvantage. And when you look at the appropriate chapter near the back of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the latest one is Velasic, and before that it was Johnson, before that it was Jasek and Johnson, there was a section on balancing devices, and some of those balances are also extremely wideband without going to exotic materials like alternating high permittivity and low permeability, low permittivity and high permeability materials. And so I'm guessing there's ways of even combining those techniques. Very rarely do we need a choking device that covers a large number of octaves. Of course, there's a couple of examples, a couple of exceptions to that. There are ultra-wideband radar antennas where you would like them to cover a number of decades. And there's certain advantages when you do that with a radar. You can get some very high resolution, range resolution, and maybe even angular resolution if you do it just right. So I guess there's a place where you would need ultra-wideband techniques. Normally they've done it, let me drop. In the past, most of the ultra-wideband antennas were built in the manner of a Vivaldi antenna. It's kind of a very tapered structure, It has some dipole-like characteristics to it, but it's a highly tapered structure. And so you could say the RF wave goes down there until it finds the right impedance. That's sort of what a log periodic does. You feed the front end, the narrow section of a log periodic, and the wave travels down those two rods until it finds some elements that are off to the side or at the resonant frequency. And so, in theory, you can build a log periodic that covers a large number of decades of to feed that log periodic is maybe what you're talking about here. Back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
What I have noticed is that the best possible performance can be summarized by saying one would like to the highest possible permeability in the ferrite and the lowest possible permittivities in both the ferrite and dielectric. So for most reasonable values of these parameters, the optimal ratio is close to half of the ferrite and dielectric in choke. Someone would also like to keep inner radius of the ferrite dielectric sandwich as small as possible. I'm just trying to make it somewhere of this paper. So this must be some kind of trade against the requirement if in a balloon to avoid interfering with the differential mode. So at this point, the need for the spacer layer in the balloon will help. However, it would be some kind of trade-off. So the final point would be that for the high frequency performance, it works very well. However, if one considers the low frequency performance, that would be worth saying that the ferrite dielectric sandwich close to the conductor is suggested, and the solid ferrite far away trying to look at the picture right now. But the rationale for this is that at a high frequency, that
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout.
Sorry about it. Okay, I don't know if I'm being heard right now.
Yes, you're being heard. Go ahead.
Okay. The rationality for it is that for the high frequency, the high frequency can penetrate only the certain distance into the sandwich. So basically, the ferrite at high frequencies has something like a skin effect, but it's a magnetic skin effect. And there was one of the things that I want to ask you, what do you know about that? So the sandwich is effective only out to that particular distance. But at lower frequency, depending on the parameters of the various materials involved, a solid ferrite can have a better performance. And it may be some kind of adventurous to combine the sandwich within the solid ferrite. The conclusion from that is... you are able to reach the certain optimized factors to achieve the highest possible incremental impedance at a high frequency. In doing that, we have a proven, based on the fact paper at least, that half-ferrite and half-dielectric provide optimal performance. that is what I say in this area, but then we have very much related to that another factor, which is anisotropic medium for high wave impedance, and there is something like a lensing, ferromagnetic lensing, which I would like to discuss with you, but first, back to you.
Ferrite material has a lot of very nice properties, and to make it operate over a whole lot of octaves can be done. Ordinarily, we use one kind of ferrite favoring our particular frequency, and as we discussed last week, we have that trade-off between how high is the permeability, or conversely, how high is the frequency you can go. By way of alternating ferrite and low permittivity materials, I see that there are ways you can go considerably higher. I can see how that can be handy. And so that could be very, very useful. When it comes to lensing, I see how ferrite material could be doing lensing. Ordinarily, lensing is done with dielectric materials, materials of a controlled amount of permittivity. But I see no reason why you can't also do it with ferrite materials.
That's the second link that I have gave you from the top.
Yeah, you're talking about the ballon antenna-like thing. What is it called now? Ballon antenna.
No. The first was the subject number one, and then you had a picture, and then you had the link right underneath of it in blue. And then right after that, you have a lensing effect. That's the link by Philips Laboratory, an anisotropic medium for the high wave impedance.
Under the picture, are you talking about under the very first picture where there are four toroids on top and then a cross section of toroids down below, or are you talking about the next picture where there's a wave going by a wire? Which one of the pictures are you talking about, Wes?
Okay, right above the second picture, lensing effect, and our special reader is to page number 6. Which you have exactly the same, which is the sandwich structure, and then this paper is related to lensing. Do you see lensing effect? So after the first picture, you have a first link, and then right next to it, at the bottom, you have, on the top of the second picture, you have a link.
Yeah, I went to the one with the number 6 alongside of it, and that opens up to a document called Measurement Notes Number 39, an anisotropic medium for high wave impedance.
That is correct.
Philips Laboratory. And so, is this the one where lensing takes place?
Yeah. Now, if you look at the abstract, the 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth line on the lens, line on the left, from the top, you see lenses. Do you see that word? And then you have this paper considers the use of special geometric hybrids, and then fifth line on the left says the transient lensing.
Okay, constant, let's see now, impedance and propagation constant for electromagnetic waves, both for transient lenses and for high wave impedance for chokes, for balance and transformers. Okay, so I think you're saying you want to discuss the lensing effects of ferrite-like materials. Is that sort of what you're saying now?
That is correct, but the thing is that the first paper that I gave you was using a spacers to play with the impedance of the ferrites and make possible the incremental impedance to be varied, altered at high frequencies. But at the same time, we have the same structure on this paper that you're looking right now, which is the Phillips laboratory, and on page number 6, you have a drawing exactly the same dielectric magnetic sandwich in half space. Now, in here, Mr. Baum, a very famous person, is describing lensing effect. That is related to another one, which is kind of shocking to me, but let's first discuss that.
I see the diagram on page number 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He's got 7 layers of material, dielectric and magnetic sandwich in half space. And he does talk about lensing. And so he starts off with artificial dielectrics have been long used for lensing effects, Dick spheres, wires, and so on. So normally the lenses that have been constructed in the past have been done either with dielectrics or with pieces of waveguide. There are pieces of waveguide that have been used to make a lens structure, a whole, what would I call it now? A matrix of waveguides all put together as a solid structure. So anything that can give you phase advance, and that's what waveguide does, it gives you a phase advance or phase delay, most dielectrics or magnetic materials will give you a decrease in propagation constant. It's kind of hard to believe that with waveguide you can get an increase in propagation constant, but it's not group delay, it is phase delay. You can make the phase operate more rapidly in the steady state. So lensing is control of velocities, and if you can control the velocity of propagation on the center of a structure versus the perimeter of a structure, that's sort of what a magnifying glass is doing, then you can do lensing of the wave. And to some degree, all high-gain antennas are using a kind of a lensing effect or an extra area effect, which really is the same thing to a certain degree. In the case of a lens, you're taking a large area, you're focusing the energy down to a smaller number of detectors. Or in the case of a phased array, you're using a large number of detectors that create the area. Gain is area. So gain is a constant times area, and many of us want gain and steerable gain. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Okay, N2XJN. Now, the final remarks of this paper, you can in the meantime look at the page number 12, is that the technique is combining the electric and magnetic media for the control of effective parameters of the hybrid medium, which this sandwich we could call hybrid, and that is being done by configuring the different media so the permittivity and conductivity is dominated by the dielectric medium and permeability is dominated by the magnetic medium, that someone can achieve some control over. The control is major factor in here. Basically, it is related to geometries of the chokes for high wave impedance that admit simple layers of such media, which more elaborate could be the transient lens geometries. The desired wave impedance may be more like a free space. This part I really have a problem to understand. However, the modern pattern can be none so simple because the magnetic field orientation varies in space. So we're dealing with a certain structure, but the structure behaves geometrically like a free space. And on the page number 16, it's kind of representation of magnetic rods embedded in the electric medium. If you could say a few words about it.
Creating a artificial dielectric or a real dielectric, or an artificial medium or a real medium, allows you to do lensing, allows you to do control of velocity of propagation and for how much of the z-axis you're controlling it, therefore how much lensing effect you get. In order to steer the beam electronically, to electronically change a dielectric constant, I think is very difficult. To electronically change mu factor by way of magnetic saturation effects, now you're talking. So I wonder if he is using magnetic slow wave structures, magnetic materials, ferrite materials, to do lensing, and now he wants to control the amount of lensing as a way of steering the beam. So with magnetics, you can do that. So is he combining lensing with electronically controlled steering of the beam that you make with the antenna? Is that what is the thrust of the article to some degree over US K2RIW?
Interaction. Yes, it is. The layers are run so that magnetic field is not interrupted in the magnetic layers, and while the insulating dielectric of low dielectric constant is used to interrupt the electric current density flowing from one magnetic layer to the next. The basic idea is to extend, I don't know how to say it, let me put it this way. Instead of layers, consider the rods, okay, of magnetic material, parallel to, let's say, y-axis. With only H to Y, the magnetic field is, in each rod, is not interrupted by any gaps. So we're not really having a very much geometrically even spacing. So, and that is explained on page 16. So X and Z components of the electric field have a certain dielectric insulation of the rod in both directions. In this particular case, they have identical radius and spacing. That will probably constitute that what you mentioned, what this paper is about. I'm trying to make a picture of how this, that mechanism works in the space. Because we're talking about structure, but then the structure is related to the free space. Back to you.
On page 16, I'm seeing 9 rods in view is what I think I'm looking at. The rods are in the Y direction, and the picture is an XZ picture. And I presume those rods are ferrite rods, mu2, E2, sigma2 is what he's saying, and in between is the mu0, E1 material. So they're being supported in probably low permittivity material, and these rods are, I guess, part of a lensing structure, and I haven't seen it yet, but I guess by some means he's introducing a nearby current in wires, maybe, to create saturation of the magnetic field of those rods in order to do steering. Is this part of a electronic steering mechanism for the antenna? Is that part of what's going on page 16? Over to US K2RIW.
When you go to page number 12, you see that sandwich in the cross section. What he's trying to say is that special layered medium is applicable to the special kind of cylindrical waves. He is dealing with the waves in here. They are sort of cylindrical because of the influence of the rods. So the same layered medium is extended over the space, except the value within the cylinder of radius is centered to the z-axis. If you go to the page number 12. Back to you.
Okay, I'm on page 12, and I'm looking at that very unusual shaped object that's made out of multiple layers. Dielectric magnetic sandwich with C0 symmetry, I think is what he's saying, or C infinity symmetry. Now, a cylindrical wave, I'm not really familiar with that. I mean, waves that propagate in free space, after you're far enough away from the emitting source, those waves have parallel lines of E, parallel lines of H, and the E and H are exactly at right angles to each other, and both are at right angles to the direction of propagation. That's a TEM wave. A cylindrical wave, I imagine, within the near field of a structure, inside of the materials itself, you can launch some pretty wild waves.
Yeah, and then imagine that you have a pulse transformer or pulse balloon.
I presume then you're using a pulsed balloon in order to make brief pulses.
Correct.
Like for a radar application. And so, is this intended to be... Now, one of the ways that they make pulses, they charge up a capacitor and discharge it across the network in order to make a electromagnetic pulse, in order to make an ultra-wideband radar. Is this intended to be an ultra-wideband radar-like antenna? Over to you, Wes.
Well, in this case, a set of cables with the shields bonded together as the gap region where the shields are broken and the inner conductor are cross-connected to each other of the shields in various ways. So, poles are transmitted in an impedance-match fashion through the gap region. In coming on the certain cables, and outgoing of others. So the purpose of the shock is to prevent current from flowing on outside of the cable shields away from the gap region. So we can consider that the cable bundle with the common outer shield is placed along the z-axis and can be considered to have a some radius. You see the B, so the B would be smaller than A. Then the exterior shield currents have the magnetic field in the phi direction, which will be the angle direction. So the example would be the parallel to the layers of desire. So the associated electric field has the components. You could think about it as the choke, a set of the alternating dielectric and magnetic washers with the cable gap region somewhere in the middle. Did I say it properly?
I'm not sure. I'm not getting a clear picture right now. The whole paper is an anisotropic medium for high wave impedances. And I'm wondering why he wants a high wave impedance. Yes, you do want a high wave impedance on something called a RFID tag, but that's a rather modern device. This was an article written in 1991, exactly 20 years ago. RFID devices were not popular then. I'm wondering why he is seeking high impedance medium.
Because he was looking for the effective parameters of the hybrid medium. He was trying to combine the electric and magnetic media to control the parameters of the hybrid medium. And he was doing this by configuring different media so the permittivity and conductivity is dominated by the electric medium. And
the time is 11 o'clock p.m.
And the permeability is dominated by magnetic medium. We can achieve some of the control over the wave impedance and the propagation constant. Back to you.
Now, the first thing that I'm remembering, I may be being unfair on this one, around 2002, 2003, a number of people were bringing to